ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, it's Lisa Leong from This Working Life, helping to make your work life better with advice from the world's top experts, like psychotherapist Esther Perel.
Many conflicts are about power. Power is when I dismiss what you're bringing up. Power is when I magnify a problem.
And Professor Adam Grant.
We need to take our critics and our cheerleaders and turn them into coaches.
Free coaching! Search for This Working Life on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you only have time to read one book this week or this month or even this year, what will it be? Well, this is the place to decide, and surely you'll come away wanting to read more than just one. Hello and welcome to ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, which is updated every week on air, on ABC Listen, or on your bookish podcast catcher of choice. I'm Kate Evans. Cassie McCullough is away this week, but she'll be back next time. Today, books both old and new. An enormously popular Cheap as Chips novel from the 1890s later in the show. That's William Lane's The Working Man's Paradise, what it was and why it's worth remembering as part of our top three Australian book series. Also, just out this week, A Ghost Town, a Western, Rabid Wolves and Tall Tales in Taya Obrett's Sunrise, and Dublin's Criminal Underworld in Jamel White's All Them Dogs. But first, to this week's big literary news. Just a few days ago, the winner of the Miles Franklin Literary Award was announced, our most prestigious award, and it went to Omar Musa for his novel Fierce Land. Omar is here with us. Hello and congratulations.
Hey, thank you so much. Yeah, it's hard to get my mind around.
But what does it mean to you, winning this award?
What does it mean to me? It means something. It doesn't mean everything, but it's a beautiful thing to be acknowledged in this way. I worked really, really hard on this book for a long time, 6 years, 21 drafts, a lot of trial and error, a lot of mistakes, a lot of self-doubt, a lot of imposter syndrome, but also a lot of love and support, you know. So to be acknowledged in this way, it feels like it's not just me, but it's a whole lot of people back in Malaysian Borneo, editors, advisors, mentors, you know, my wife, my mother, my family. Yeah, it's amazing.
Well, 6 years, a lot of grappling and a lot of ideas as well in this novel. So how would you describe this book of yours, where it takes us and what you wanted it to do?
Ooh, well, I guess at its heart, it's a family drama. It's an epic. I used these family dynamics as a window to look at broader issues and themes around corruption, colonialism, power, complicity, and at the history of my homeland, Malaysian Borneo, and in particular, the forest, land, language. So I guess it's a book about ghosts, really, you know? It's about the things we've lost that we might hope we can regenerate, whether that's the land, languages, you know, a sense of dignity, purpose and direction. Yeah, I was balancing a lot. I was juggling a lot of different ideas.
And as you say, it's also a family story, and yeah, it begins by us meeting a pair of children and, you know, and we trace them at different times of their lives. But how would you describe them as children? Who are these two?
So it's about two siblings. One's called Rosanna, the other one Harun. Rosanna is wild and rebellious and artistic. Harun is much more kind of icy cold, bit business-minded, but there's a lot going on beneath the surface. And they're both impacted in different ways by a trauma that occurs or something that they witness in the forest, something that their father does. And so as I started getting into this book, I realized that this was about the way we try to grapple with what we inherit in life, whether it's a literal inheritance, because that's what they're grappling with, and what to do with their privilege. But it's also what we inherit from colonial powers, what we inherit from those in power, the sins maybe that we inherit from our parents, and how to mourn not just people we've lost, but maybe dreams of nationhood. Because I think a lot of, I was fascinated by this idea by a certain type of person that I would meet, usually say of my parents' age, who had had very high hopes for their nation when the nation was new, but then had fallen into disillusionment as the nation fell into venality and corruption. So not just people from Malaysia, but even, you know, people from the Philippines or Indonesia, places like that, but obviously other places around the world too. And so oftentimes these seemed like very tragic, lost people to me. But then what of us who were the children of these lost people? Does that mean we're doubly lost? Maybe that's true, but maybe it also means that we can come up with new vocabularies and new ways of seeing and moving forward.
And you play around with the language of memory and storytelling and of language itself, all of which is part of the sort of music of this novel. And I say music because you are also a musician and a performer and a poet. And there's all these sounds in this book, the sound of the forest, of different languages and accents as we move in and out of place. Mm. How important was it for you to have a sort of a soundtrack to this novel?
Yeah, it was really important. Thank you for picking up on that. Yeah, I really wanted actually each of the characters to have their own musicality. Even if it was the gangster, Jibrail, who's the rich man's right-hand man, who's very profane and harsh, but he actually has his own musicality as well. I wanted to bring all of those textures out because the way that we speak and the slang that we use, the musicality of our speech, tells us so much about the spirit of a place. And so something like my first novel, Here Come the Dogs, where I was using a lot of Queanbeyan slang, hip-hop slang, Aussie slang.
That
came very naturally to me. But I realized when I was writing this book that actually I had maybe a bit of a disconnect or a bit of a blind spot because I was born and raised in Australia, not in Malaysian Borneo. And Sabahans, people from Kota Kinabalu and Sandakan, where my dad comes from, have a really particular way of speaking. So I actually had to work quite hard on that and get people to advise me and help me bring forward that musicality. But then when it came to something like the forest itself, oh, that's a major character of the book. That was a whole different type of channeling. That was, you know, me having to spend a lot of time listening, going on journeys upriver into the forest, trying to get that essence of, you know, what it might say if it did have a voice. And of course, the forest has many voices. One thing, you know, not having spent a lot of time there as a kid, was that I always thought of the forest as maybe being this very silent, solemn place. But actually, the forest is really loud and noisy and rich with music and voices. And so I was trying to channel that when I came to write the book. And so I had to write those sections in poetry because I wanted to capture the danger, the playfulness, the flamboyance of the jungle.
The other thing about both this book and this award, Omar, is that the Miles Franklin is framed as a search for literature that presents Australian life in any of its phases. Now, in Fierce Land, that means both being in Australia and in the region, in Borneo and in Nigeria and in, well, and even into the sort of history of Australia's relationship with the region in the Colombo Plan in the 1960s. So what does that mean to you, that you've written this novel that places what's partly an Australian story in our region?
Well, we are fundamentally connected with our region, and I think that should be emphasised, it should be celebrated. I'm a product of the time that I grew up in. You know, when I was growing up in the 90s, there was much more of this idea that we were part of the Asia-Pacific region, that we might study Asian languages in primary school and high school. And I think throughout the 2000s, a lot of that got kind of lost, where there was a bit more of a harking back towards the old British kind of connections. And then now we hear all this rhetoric about a monoculture when actually that's just impossible. I mean, there's no such thing. Even under the White Australia policy, which was an attempt to create a monoculture, that did not exist either. And so I think that if we are to create an Australian literature, it must necessarily be connected with the region and cross-pollinate ideas, languages, voices from our region, because otherwise it's not true to who we are as a nation as we move forward. When so many of us come from kind of blended diasporas from around the world, it only makes sense to create a literature, or in this case, just a single book that is outward looking, not insular. So it can be based in the local, but it's not parochial. It has a view to the world.
Well, Fierce Land is a fierce and deserved winner. Congratulations again, Omar Musa.
Thank you so much.
And thank you so much for speaking to us on The Bookshelf. And for a longer conversation with Omar about his pulsing, powerful novel, check out Claire Nichols' podcast special interview with him for The Book Show. Now on The Bookshelf, it's time to welcome this week's reviewers as we hear about a collection of new books. With us today, novelists Madeline Gray and Michael Rowbotham, both Shelfie regulars. Hello and hello.
Hi, Kate.
Hello, Kate.
Have you appeared together before? Michael, this is Madeline. Madeline, this is Michael.
This is a first meet.
It's very exciting. Anything could happen.
It's a meet cute.
Well, to keep it very cute, how about you explain your own milieu to each other? Your oeuvre in two sentences, Madeline.
I would say I write contemporary literary fiction that deals with women attempting to understand life in late capitalism.
Wow.
And yours, Michael, Murder Most Foul?
Yeah, I kill people for a living. And I've killed about 165 so
far. That's so cool. I've only killed one person and one dog.
Oh, yeah, that gets you into trouble, though, killing dogs.
I know.
I tried that once. My mother threatened to kill me.
Well, and for those who've come in late, we're talking Michael Rowbotham, internationally acclaimed crime writer, whose books include The Secrets She Keeps, When You Are Mine, and The White Crow, and his next novel, Tell Me Something True, is out at the end of September. And Madeline Gray is a novelist and literary scholar. She resists that label, but it works. Her books are Green Dot and Chosen Family. So the books you've both read for us. Let's stick with major awards, shall we, and begin with a debut novel that's just been longlisted for the Booker Prize. It's by Irish writer Jamel White. It's called All Them Dogs, and it takes us to the outskirts of Dublin and into the head of a young man called Tony Ward. Actually, do you want to read just the first paragraph or so from it, Michael, just to give us a sense of the voice?
First thing you always notice going into a stranger's gaff is the smell. Damp and smoky, that sickly sweet smell of a spoonful of gear. It paints a picture. Once you've seen one gaff, you've seen them all. I let the opal roll into the spot in front of the apartment building. One of Finto's fellas coming up short on his dividends, we'd been told.
Okay, and there we are. We're in the outskirts of Dublin. But what do we learn about Tony, where he's been, where he is now?
Yeah, Tony is he's coming home after 5 years away. He fled Dublin in his teens after he'd killed a rival gang member in a stabbing and had to sort of make himself scarce. And he's sort of been lying low in London, and he's finally coming home, but he doesn't quite know whether he's going to be welcome, whether there's still enemies out there, whether he needs protection. But right from the outset, we know that this is a very troubled young man.
We're in the sort of underworld in a way. We're crime adjacent, but this isn't a conventional crime novel, is it?
Yeah, there's no mystery. It's not a whodunit. This is a real slice of life, you know, look into the darkest underbelly. It's a genre of Irish crime fiction actually called crack cocaine in terms of the Irish definition of crack. And it is very dark and very bleak. And And it's, you know, it's not something that Guy Ritchie is going to film, or if it did, it's Guy Ritchie without the jokes, because there's not a great deal of humour in this book. It's looking at desperate people doing desperate things.
And we're very much inside the perspective of this young man, Tony, who, as you say, has been away. Now he's back. He's trying to work out how he's going to operate in the world. But something interesting happens, I think, at the end of the second page. He's paired up with this other guy, Darren, who he knows as Flute, because they went to school together. Everybody's got nicknames. They're sort of very much caught up in the sort of mythology of their younger days. And the story was that Darren had shown his penis to somebody else, and that's why he was known as Flute, and known as Flute forevermore.
Bummer that it wasn't a bigger instrument.
Yeah. It's interesting because Tony Ward's recollection of Flute was this meek boy at school, very quiet boy at school. But now he's a big man and he is brooding and he's still quiet, but he's actually the enforcer for, you know, the biggest, most powerful gangster in West Dublin. And Darren basically, you know, offers, or the gangster offers Tony protection and also a job that he can work alongside Flute and be his enforcers.
But there's something interesting about the way that Tony observes this hulking man who he used to know as teenagers. He refers to Flute's blue eyes like a husky or one of those pit bulls with a grey-blue coat, one of those dogs that stare at you without so much as a tail wag, the sort that'd make you think twice about reaching your hand out. They were something else to look at, all the same. Gorgeous animals. And so there's that mixture of sort of violence and attraction that's there from the start. There's a frisson between these two.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's actually been pitched as a gay love story. I think that's a stretch.
A tragedy maybe?
Yeah. I think it's closer to being a tragedy because Tony's gay, but that makes him angry and he's not willing to admit that he's gay. Whereas Flute, you know, is gay, but it's far more comfortable with his sexuality. And Tony is basically angry. I mean, he's one of those guys that if you look at him the wrong way, if you bump into him in a pub and spill his drink, I mean, he's just on the edge of always exploding.
And he wants to explode, doesn't he? And that's part of the tension of it, is he's walking through these suburbs and there's kids who were just like the kid he was, who are arcing up and taking up space, and he's desperate for one of them to bump into him. He wants things to kick off. He wants that violence to erupt. He sort of needs it.
Yeah, and I'm not quite sure whether that is because of the internal struggle over his sexuality or I don't think it's fully explained why he's so angry. I know he's been 5 years away. I mean, you do ask the question when he gets back, why have you bothered coming back? Because you just seem to be angry and hate everything about this community and this place. And you were just this powder keg, you know, absolute powder keg.
Are we in the contemporary moment?
Yeah, no, very much so. Very much set in the here and now. And I think it's one of the reasons it's so powerful, but it's also, for me, one of the reasons why it's so depressing.
Yeah, exactly. So, but we know from the gay drug lord, you know, great representation there for queer drug lords, that, you know, queerness isn't necessarily a bad thing in this environment. So why doesn't the other guy come out?
Well, it's interesting. I think, you know, I don't know whether you would say it's not such a bad thing.
Okay.
I mean, I know it's almost trope-like. You know, you have the Cray twins, you know, one of the Cray twins being gay or bisexual.
Yeah.
And I know that certainly in literature and film and TV, you've had, you know, the gay drug lord has been represented in Breaking Bad, for example, and other things. But I don't think Tony sees it as something that, you know, I think if someone actually accused him of being gay, he would kick off in a big, big way.
And also, we're talking a poor working class community. This isn't sort of high-level criminality. This is just getting by, and it's poverty. And his return to, you know, his single mum, who's always in a dressing gown smoking cigarettes and cooking bacon over the stove. his half-brother, who he's never got on with. And at one point, that explodes. And our character, Tony, is sort of screaming at his half-brother, I'm not my da. You know, I'm not the violent man who brought you up. And yet he sort of is. This is the whole world he's come from and that they're caught up in. But they are sort of always harking back to the past and to childhood days. And he's staying with an old school friend called Kenny. And he wants to remember Kenny as the wild kid, the kid who, you know, threw garbage bins through windows. But now he's a single dad with an 11-year-old daughter who's made an effort to sort of bring him in. That's sort of heartbreaking too, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I think the whole novel is heartbreaking. You know, even though there's probably only one character in the entire book that I actually liked, because most of the others were incredibly selfish, you know, and violent. But I think, you know, the way he does hark back to childhood, but it's always, you know, the endless summers and barefoot and all the pranks they pulled. And, you know, he was dealing drugs, you know, as a young, you know, barely teenager, he was dealing drugs back then, you know, but he loved those days. He loved the sort of freedom that the extra money gave him, and the carrying a knife made him feel like a big man.
And even just the tragedy of having to escape, having stabbed somebody as a, you know, as a teenager and having to disappear to London, that's part of his backstory. But there's not really a sense that he's going to be able to escape from it. This violence is haunting the whole book.
No, absolutely. I mean, the mere fact that he embraces so quickly or seeks out the sort of mentorship of Flute and obviously the crime lord that employs them isn't just because he needs to make a living, but he needs the umbrella of protection because he killed someone 5 years earlier and he doesn't know whether that person's family or friends, I mean, he would never tried or charged with it, you know, but he's pretty sure that people in the area will know that he was responsible. And so he's always looking over his shoulder. So the whole book is laced through with this tension and suspense from the moment he steps back into West Dublin.
And because he's an enforcer, he's there as muscle. He's turning up at people's houses to say, you know, you owe us money, you need to pay up. Again and again, there are babies, toddlers, small children looking on. What do you think that does to the book?
I think it makes it even sadder because, I mean, it doesn't matter whether it's a woman or a man or, you know, there is a hit in the book where, you know, where they have to go and take someone
finish
out
someone.
And finish someone off. And there is, you know, a baby crying in the background of that. They don't care.
So I guess, Madeline, what we're describing to you is a book that is violent and bleak and tough. And maybe what we haven't made clear is what makes a book like this worth reading, because I couldn't look away from it. I wanted to keep reading it. And also it has been recognised. It is on the long list for the Booker. So why?
Well, from my point of view, I think it's the reason that people drive past road accidents slowly.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, even though you realise you shouldn't look, you know, it's a train wreck of a book. You are just waiting for this train to come off the rails from the moment it starts. And it's because I found that all of those things that you said, I think it's beautifully written. I think the dialogue sparkles. The sense of foreboding and suspense is incredible. It's a beautiful job, particularly for a debut, but it is just so damn depressing. Maybe it's a sign of the times and the world we live in that I'm tending to gravitate towards more uplifting books, or books that have some sort of redemptive sort of nature, because this book has nothing redemptive in it. Beautifully done, but just depressing.
It is so beautifully done, though, and there's a sense of, I mean, it's such a physical book. There's a little quote, it's actually fairly late in the book, but it's not giving away the story. It's Tony and his awareness of this other young man, Flute. I knew he was in there. Sounds mad, but I could feel it. That was the change in me he'd caused. It used to be chest puffed up, laughing down my nose at the world. It was hot summers and gold chains on bare chests, tyre smoke and busted eyebrows. It was fast gas and gangster rap, and it was not giving a single flying whatever what anyone thought of you and not taking no shit from no one. And now it was this salad bowl feeling, all brittle around the rim. And again, maybe you think there's going to be some redemption there with that salad bowl feeling all brittle around the rim, but there's something tougher. Yeah. There's something coming.
Maybe that's the nature of the books I write or my outlook on life, I wanted there to be redemptive, something redemptive at the end. I wanted that love to sort of somehow blossom or to be some form of escape. But I could see why they couldn't be. I can see exactly why Jamal White had to end the book the way he ends it. And I'm not going to give the ending away. But as I said, what you've just quoted then is a beautiful piece of writing.
It's got this thing in my head. You know the phrase, like, is Don is good? I'm just thinking, is Booker is bleak?
Yeah, I think this ticks a lot of boxes when it comes to the Booker.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's interesting. I don't know whether I'd call it a tragedy, only because tragedies that I think of in terms of obviously the classic, we talk about Shakespearean tragedies, it's normally to see a great person brought down. I don't see Tony Ward as being a great person or a tragic figure. I see him as being someone that was just destined for disaster, and that's what we see play out.
Jamel White's All Them Dogs is published by John Murray. I'm Kate Evans with guests novelist Madeline Gray, whose latest is Chosen Family, and Michael Rowbotham, whose latest is The White Crow, but whose 20th novel, Tell Me Something True, will be out at the end of September. And now we're turning to the latest from American writer Taya Obrett, whose earlier novels were The Tiger's Wife, Inland, which, just by the way, was an almost hallucinogenic Western, The Morningside, and now Sunrise. So, oh my goodness, Madeline Gray, so much happens in this novel, but it begins in the present with a woman alone. Her name is Nina. Where is she and what's happened?
Nina is somewhere in Wyoming, and she has been in a two-person plane with her boyfriend, and the plane has crashed. And she's ended up in a lake called Horsebone Lake. And, you know, things aren't looking good for Nina. She's got to find shelter. She's got to not die. She doesn't know if her boyfriend's dead and her phone's, you know, doesn't have any reception. So this part of the story is kind of an adventure and survival tale.
And we're told that it's an incident over Horsebone Lake in 2024. But as I was reading it, I was quite discombobulated and I couldn't work out whether it had really happened, whether she'd really survived being pushed out or fallen out of a plane. Mm-hmm. Was this the afterworld, an afterlife? Like, I was just trying to orient myself and work out whether it was real. And part of what was discombobulating was that Nina is trying to orient herself.
I mean, I'm just looking at my notes here and I just have written down fog, lots of fog. and I do, that sounds silly, but that is the atmosphere that this first section evokes, dreamy. And in a way, for a reference to popular culture that might help listeners understand the vibe, it was kind of like Widow's Bay. It had a sense of sinisterness in the air. And yeah, we don't know if she's dead or not. And that is a recurring theme throughout the book, ghosts. And how our memories live on in others.
And as she's orienting herself, so she's managed to get out of this huge, really, really deep lake and climb up the cliffs, and she finds a town. She's still got a phone, but it doesn't work. Mm. And she's trying to find some way to charge it, but there's no sign of electricity. There's old cash registers. Mm. There's no sort of sign of the contemporary world. So maybe she's lost in time. I mean, there's no sign of the present. Mm. So what is this place?
Well, I think we're establishing pretty quickly, it kind of has the energy of like an old frontier town that you would see in a Western. You know, you can imagine that maybe a hay bale is going to go past. And slowly but surely, she's putting things together. There's, like you say, no electricity. There is, you know, a saloon. There's a hotel. There's, you know, some shops along the way. And slowly but surely, she begins to orient herself. A lot of that happens because she comes across a story. It's a tricky book to talk about because there's so much plot involved and you really don't want to ruin it for anyone.
But I think what we can say is that she's in a sort of ghost town.
Yes.
And that we end up finding out the history of this place through those conventions,
yes,
like a found manuscript.
So this is not like an Outlander story, is it, where she's suddenly gone back in time?
Sing me a song.
You know, where she's suddenly modern lass has been transported back into the old frontier.
Yeah, Sassenach.
No. But we aren't sure at first because this initial part of the book is so sort of odd. But then we meet other sections, and then there's another section that's in that we're told is in 1902, and then there's a section that's, you know, another number of years later. And so what we get are the origin stories of this town. We meet a man named Anton.
Oh, so Nina's not in each of these stories, but she's just the initial vehicle for the...
That's correct. And she comes back later. So we've got these three timelines. So it's 1902 and then the other one's 2003.
And the 1902 story takes us back into the 19th century.
Gotcha.
Correct. And she plays with form as well, because the 1902 section is ostensibly a novel that someone has written. It's called Sunrise by L.T. Hawley. So we understand that we're reading a story, not the truth. The truth, I'm, you know, doing quotation marks with my hands for the listeners. And then in 2003, we've got Cole. And Cole is an amateur historian who lives in Sunrise and is obsessed with the kind of founding myths of the town, which we've now learnt about from the Sunrise novel. So they're all coming together in this interesting way where we don't really know what's true, but we're certainly learning about the power of myth-making.
Myth-making and American myth-making,
yeah,
and the power of that sort of Western idea of settlement and of frontiers. And that's, by the time I got to that, I thought, oh, I am so in. because we've got this character, Anton, who at first we're not sure who he is, because we discover he'd been the star of dime novels and he'd been in like Western gunslinger,
yeah,
shows. And so I think, is he a trickster? Is he a performer? What's this telling us? And then we realise that from his name and from other things, he's got a Mexican ethnic background.
Mm-hmm.
There's a man named Preacher who is a doctor, and then there are two other characters, and they're the founders of this town, and one of these other characters is a Native American. So it seems to me that she's both making and then unmaking and playing with those stories of the origins of America.
Absolutely. I mean, again, not to spoil anything, but there are lots of twists and turns in this book and reveals, and you can see that the author is having a bit of fun. She's playing with the narrative tropes of the Wild West. And I think there's one explicit line in the book where someone says, you know, this land was empty, and then someone says, like, I don't reckon it was. So there's that, you know, that is kind of the project that she's doing in a much more complex way than what I just said.
It's a sort of satisfying project in a way, because it is a sort of post-colonial project in the way that we're familiar with it in Australia.
Yeah.
And so there's a sense of First Nations people being displaced, and there's a sense of contested stories. And then there's some surprising wacky bits with wolves and ghosts and blood and all sorts of things,
yeah,
going on. And also she's using the section headings are like turn-of-the-century novels. An incident at the cabin bar outside the town of Salt Draw, the Grey Rock Four and the founding of our community, an incident at Burnt Creek on the occasion of a homecoming, 1902.
Yeah. Or like an old school, you know, movie where, like a silent film where it comes up with little slides between. That was what I was being reminded of.
Well, it's
of.
Very cinematic,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is. I mean, getting back into Maddie's backstory. As a child, my father made me watch a lot of old films, and I remember watching High Noon again and again with him. Basically, this book is taking High Noon and rearranging it like a puzzle.
And there are queer desires and underpinnings in
there
this story
are,
as
yes.
well.
Yes, there are.
Yes, there are, we whisper. There are ghosts in here as well,
gay ghosts,
dear listeners. But there's also doubt, isn't there? I mean, we're always forced to doubt the narrative that we're reading.
Yes.
And even to doubt what happened with Nina.
Yeah.
Who is this boyfriend of hers? What's she doing?
What
Why
happened to
she?
Nina? Isn't that the name of a Deborah McKiernan book?
It is, yes.
Wow, everything's connected. But yeah, we don't really know what's happening, and the kind of fogginess, the atmospheric fogginess of the beginning continues to enshroud the whole book. And by the end, we think we know what happened, but because of the nature of the passages that have come before, it could be trickery.
Do we come back to Nina?
We come back to Nina.
And it's not, Nina hasn't taken this whole journey, or we think, has Nina taken this journey?
Well, she's partly taken this journey as a reader. Mm.
So Nina's, in a sense, the reader is Nina and having taken this journey.
Yeah, I think Nina is certainly the character that, like, as the reader that we identify the most with. We go along Nina's trajectory and path.
And because you're not sure at first, that's part of the fun of it. It's like, how is she going to pull all of these different threads together, all of these characters together, and also all of these themes in American literature, and one that I have brought up so many times here on the bookshelf and that I had my eye out for, which is what the terrible American health system does to people.
Mm.
And there's a character in here, Cole. His sister is 7 or 8 months pregnant, and you're not quite sure why she's there in the story. And then you discover that she's pregnant for a surrogate because of her parents' medical debt. And I just see this theme, even as a subplot, in so much American writing.
Yeah, I will say this is a side note, but about the sister. She's gay, which is not a surprise, but that fact then complicates a twist that comes later towards the end. And that was a twist that didn't really work for me. Do you know? Anyway.
Well, the other thing that I was waiting for was, so we know that there are four characters who founded this town and around whom all of these mythologies grew. And one of them, we don't get her story.
No.
And I would have really liked to have got her story as well. It's hinted at and it's wild.
Yeah, me too. I don't know. Is that a statement about the erasure of women's voices? I'm not sure.
But we get an intriguing paragraph. And so if I had a chance to interview Taya Obrett, I'd want to know if she'd written this character's story and somehow deleted it, why she didn't give it to us. And as you say, whether it's deliberate, because it feels like quite a carefully constructed book.
Yes, absolutely.
What else do you need to know, Michael, as you decide whether this is one you'd want to read or not?
When you mention the ghosts, gay ghosts, how much magic realism is in the story?
I wouldn't say a huge amount. It's kind of more sporadic wisps than fog.
Yeah, I think she's quite restrained with that. And in fact, you're not even sure
if it is magic realism or not.
Yeah, because, you know, Nina has, I think, an Eastern European background, as Taya Obrett herself does, which means that her mother character consults soothsayers and talks about death and tells Nina that she only has a certain number of heartbeats left. And so this is a story that the character has been told, which means the idea of knowing your end is sort of in there, but it's not... It's not Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Okay.
No.
And the other question, I guess, because you talk about how it somehow reflects America in many ways and the development of America, how is this book likely to be received in America by, let's say, the right wing?
Oh, I don't think they'll love it, do you?
I wouldn't say it's going on a certain someone's reading list. No, probably not. My kind of, I always write down one line that I think kind of sums up the book, and this is when... someone's being accused of messing with their version of the past. It says, "You make believe that you are unimpeachable, but you have a way of misremembering things so that they align only with your most recent feelings." And that's at the core of this.
Mm.
And it's different to the book that you guys reviewed, but also not so dissimilar in the fact that it is just very sad. Very, very sad.
Sad but not bleak.
Sad but not bleak,
okay.
Exactly.
Maybe I think I'm going to read that.
And a pretty satisfying read. Like, I was really held.
Oh, yeah. And it's just plotty. I love that, you know, because I often read a lot of literary fiction where nothing happens, and I like that too. But this is great. I was like, have fun.
It is very plotty. And that's Taya Obrett's Sunrise, published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. Here on The Bookshelf, we're talking new fiction, recommendations and reviews with me, Kate Evans, and with novelists Madeline Gray and Michael Robotham. And I wonder if I could tell you both about another book I accidentally read
Please.
This week. Now, Michael, remember that we both read a few weeks ago Andrew Sean Greer's Villa Coco, a novel that made a case for the novel as diversion.
It was his comfort novel.
Yeah, and charm novels.
Charm novel, that's right, charm novel.
Well, I read one that really was a diversion, a confection,
okay.
In fact. And it's got all the elements of melodrama. So it's called The Unselected Journals of Emma M. Lyon by Beth Brower, Volumes 1 and 2. It's historical fiction.
It's a young woman who grew up in a house that she loved in a mysterious and invented corner of London. There's a sort of mild bits of magic, like things disappear from houses and they all end up in a special shelf in a shop. And there's a benign ghost who occasionally appears in people's backyards. But that's not really the focus of the story. So you've got a young woman, she's orphaned at the age of 13. The house has been left to her, but there's a dastardly uncle by marriage who takes over the house. She's at the mercy of the terrible uncle who deliberately spends all the money because he's resentful. She's feisty, she's clever, she's unconventional. She ends up having to live in the garret. There's a mysterious and handsome tenant who lives on the other side of the wall, and they pass each other letters through a crack in the wall in a sort of Pyramus and Thisbe kind of way. She has to live by her wits. She has a beautiful friend in society. There's frocks, and there's another handsome stranger down the street.
Say no more, babe.
There's a roguish thief who's a ne'er-do-well. It's a flummery of ridiculousness. I could not put it down as an antidote to all the bleakness.
I hope you've cleaned your teeth and flossed well afterwards, eating so much candy. You know that's going to be terrible for you. Yeah, having read the Jemal White book, All Them Dogs, I think maybe I need a bit of that.
Sometimes you do need a different type of reading, almost as a palate cleanser.
Absolutely.
No, completely agree. I think, you know, it's why one of my great philosophies and rules for reading is that you should at least once a year read completely outside your comfort zone and pick up a book of in a genre that you would not normally read, but pick the right one and broaden your horizons. And I think, well, it's a bit like, you know, the other thing is if when you've been eating steak for a long, long time, beans taste fine. And so you can't just live on steak.
Yeah, bring on the tofu and veggie stir fry. So in the interest of that, enough about me, I want your recommendations. So Madeline Gray.
Yes, okay. So I've got two recommendations this week. Neither of them are new. The first one is Aileen Morton Robinson's Talking Up to the White Woman, which I think came out in 2000 or 2002. It's nonfiction and it's an excellent book by a feminist scholar who's First Nations, who is basically dismantling all the ways that Australian white feminism is bad. But she writes in this, it's a scholarly book, but it's conversational, and I feel like anyone can read it. It was republished a few years back after its 20-year anniversary and with a new kind of foreword, and it just becomes more and more pertinent, I feel, in this country. I haven't read another book like it that's just so thorough.
And also this is in the context of us leading up to the top 100 Australian books countdown, where people need to think, or not need to, they can think about both fiction and non-fiction, books that have influenced them,
books that you think everyone should read.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you said you had two. What's the other one?
So that's the first one. The second one is one that is, I think it came out in the 60s, and it is called Fall Girl by Jill Neville. And Jill Neville was a playwright and an author, but some people might know her as being Richard Neville's sister of Oz magazine. And this book is about a young woman who moves to London and then falls into two affairs, which are like clearly based on two actual poets that you can Google it. and then she kind of, you know, falls into disarray. It's about single motherhood. It's about growing up, but it's really funny and sassy and smart, and it feels really modern. And Virago Modern Classics in the UK have just bought it to be published again next year. So I think that's it's a really good one. It makes the point that something that's funny and true will stay funny and true forever.
And the fact that people can still find it and get it is a great thing.
Yeah.
So that's Fall Girl by Jill Neville, published in 1966. Michael Rowbotham.
I have just finished reading A Short History of Longins by Mirandi Riwo. This is a sort of reverse family history. It's written in four parts over 200 years. It goes backwards. It begins in 2049, and you hear from Daniel, one of the narrators. And each of these stories could be a novella in its own right, but they are all linked by family and by a Longan tree, which is sort of in the very, very opening scene, has been felled in a storm, but the story goes backwards. It's beautifully done. It's a story, I think, about family and ties, and also about a cross-cultural story in a sense, because Mirandi herself is from a sort of Asian-Irish background, and she manages to weave into this family both of those threads in the research you've done into the Chinese element of a family and also the Irish elements of the family?
I'm about 80 pages in to this novel. Oh, no, I'm not. I'm 113 pages in. I've just opened up my copy. And it just feels so very assured. I mean, I read her earlier books, Stone Sky, Gold Mountain, and The Fish Girl, which I loved, which is her debut novella, and then another one in between set in Java in the 1940s. This one feels more assured in a way, in the way that she's taking us into these different moments and giving us different versions of Australia.
It's interesting. You know you're in very good hands to pull off a structure like this to begin with, but each time you leave one of these characters and jump back in time 50 years, you don't want to leave them. And she manages to just give you enough that you really want to stay with those characters for longer, but you're also fascinated then by the next character she introduces. But I think I've read all of Mirandi's stuff, and I think this is incredibly accomplished, and I think it's going to get a great buzz.
Is there anything else you wanted to throw in?
Yeah, I'm going
to
throw in a non-fiction. Amy Remikus has written a book which is called Screw Nice, and it's an antidote to the let them theory, which has become one of the, you know, huge best-selling sort of self-help books of the last few years, that convinces people that letting people get away with bad behavior, you know, like water off a duck's back, will actually make you a lot happier. You know, to just let them, basically, is the message. Don't sweat the small stuff. Chill, baby, chill. And Amy writes a polemic where she argues that the politics of politeness and turning the other cheek actually shuts down debate and increases bad behaviour. And the only way to counter this is to speak up and screw being nice, stop being a doormat, stand up for yourself.
Yeah.
And it's enormous fun.
That sounds so great. I've got a copy of that book, and it was giving, you read any of Sara Ahmed's work?
Yes.
And it sounds like a kind of new version of the feminist killjoy, which is, you know, my favourite character in life. So that sounds really good.
It's wonderful.
And sitting there with her feminist killjoy T-shirt on is Madeline Gray. Michael Robotham, what T-shirt can I make up for you? I'm not quite sure. But never fear, we do list all of the books mentioned here, both those that we talk about in depth and those we mention in passing in the bookshelf show notes. It's all on ABC Listen, or do yourself a quick searching favour. Check out all the books by our favourite reviewers here while you're doing that work. Michael, Madeline, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Kate.
Crime writer Michael Robotham and novelist Madeline Gray. But don't go anywhere here on the bookshelf, because there are more books to come. It's time to scan your bookshelves, your libraries, your memories, as we address the history of Australian books and reading ahead of the Top 100 Books Countdown. But then again, it's also worth turning to books you haven't already read, don't know enough about, or perhaps have not even heard of. So our next guest here on the bookshelf is Professor Nicole Moore from the University of New South Wales in Canberra, who specialises in Australian literature and has also written on the history of censorship. She has selected her top three books, and this is her first.
The first book I've gone with it's relatively obscure now. And I think, Kate, this is partly because this feels like my job as a professor of Australian literature and as a teacher, to pay attention to the books that fade from view, but were really important at the time, or even marginalised unfairly, and that we really need to have bring back into contemporary memory. It helps us think about the diversity of our cultural life and the ways in which our memory can be diversified, so that we have a better sense of who we have been and how we've imagined who we have been. So my first one is then A Working Man's Paradise by William Lane, The Working Man's Paradise by William Lane, which is published in 1892, and a hugely interesting book for lots of really complex political and social reasons.
So people might recognise, if people recognise that name, it will be because he was the leader of that utopian settlement that went to Paraguay. So who was William Lane, and how did he come to write a novel?
Yes, such an interesting figure. So a journalist as well as a political activist, but primarily a journalist working in Brisbane originally and working for the working class press effectively in Brisbane and elsewhere, and caught up in the great shearers' strikes of the early 1890s, which, of course, many of your listeners will know, formed the beginnings of the Australian Labor Party. So a crucial part of Australia's political history, and he's a mover and shaker in that political history, but primarily a writer, reporter, yeah, working with words and working, importantly, to use words to get out to a readership beyond the educated classes, to itinerant shearers, itinerant working labourers in a period in Australia of economic depression and huge pressure on wages and living conditions. So he's caught up in the world that Henry Lawson is part of and Mary Gilmore and other writers of that period, deeply involved in the question of how it is to live, just basically survive in Australia without money, and particularly in the rural parts of Australia. And out of this period, of course, it's the Bulletin era, and we've got Patterson writing as well. We have some of Australia's most evocative writers trying to imagine a new way of living in Australia and a new way of being Australian that's grounded in these really difficult conditions for workers of all kinds, including Aboriginal workers, including Chinese workers who are struggling just to make a basic living.
So this is a political project on the one hand, but how does it work as a novel? What's the story that he wants to tell?
It's set in Sydney, even though he's a Brisbane writer, and it has at its heart a kind of romantic relationship between Ned and Nellie. Great names, I think. Mm-hmm. And there's also a fantastic character called Connie Stratton, who's a kind of bohemian. And out of that, we have this Ned figure landing in Sydney, coming from Brisbane, coming from the northern parts of Queensland and the shearers' strikes, and attempting to get some sense in Sydney of how Sydney as a metropolis can grapple with workers' rights. So Nellie effectively and Connie give him a tour of the slums of Sydney, the intricate workings of the streets and backwaters and shops of Sydney, and the idea is to build solidarity for what's going on in northern Queensland. But we get from Lane, it's a really evocative book about a Sydney we don't know at all anymore.
But at the time, how popular was it? I mean, who was he writing for?
Yeah, so it's published as a cheap novel. He's writing for a working class readership, which is striking for us, I think. It's only in the 1870s that compulsory primary school education is brought into Australia. So it's only 20 years into having a properly literate population in Australia. So the idea that he's writing a novel that everyone might be able to read is really important to him, but it's more than that. It's really a novel that's kind of trying to reflect back to this building of a socialist movement. It's a novel of ideas, and it's full of these autodidact characters, yeah, working class characters who are educated off their own bat, who read the working class press, who read the European magazines, who are caught up in the ideas of social change and articulate it in very rhetorical, highly rhetorical style. It has some parallels with Furphy, such as Life, of course, the other great ideas novel that comes out 10 years later. This one's much smaller and shorter and more closely engaged with city life than Such as Life, but they're both novels of ideas that are engaged with this question of the future of Australia. So it's called The Working Man's Paradise for obvious reasons. Yeah, this question of, you know, if Australia's at the forefront of labour rights, can it build a paradise? Can we build a paradise in this settler colony where notionally for Europeans, they're building a society from scratch? Can you make it different? Can you make it better? And those ideas are infused all the way through it.
And so that's William Lane's The Working Man's Paradise, published in 1892. Nicole Moore, give us your second pick.
My second pick is another novel that is about Australia. And I think this is what I've done, Kate. I'm thinking about what criteria I've used. I think I've picked novels, or I've picked books that are a kind of critique of Australia as such. But certainly this one, Rosa Capiello's Oh Lucky Country from 1984, is another one, like Working Man's Paradise, that has in its title an address to Australia as a nation as such. And perhaps that's what makes them worth counting as a great Australian book. And this one's another marginalised one that's marginalised at its time and forgotten now in many ways, by Rosa Capiello, but has a really extraordinary history. So Capiello was an Italian migrant, a working class Italian migrant woman who wrote this novel first in Italian, and it's first published in Italy by the Italian publisher Feltrinelli in 1981, and immediately it won the Premier Calabria Prize for that year. So it was won a really prestigious Italian prize, but it's also a novel that's set in working class Sydney. Capiello arrived in Australia from Naples in 1971. She's a proper economic migrant, looking for new opportunities. It's the second novel written in Italian after she had a car accident, and so she had to stay in hospital. And she wrote this extraordinary novel that at the same time was greeted with cries of horror and vilification, said its translator, from parts of the Australian Italian community, especially the more affluent, because it's highly critical of Australia. She was working in clothing factories, facing regular unemployment, and it's about the struggle. She's set in a new boarding houses in Newtown in Sydney, and it's a really, a novel that damns the migrant's paradise, the working woman's paradise. It's really, its title, Oh Lucky Country, of course, taken from the 1964 Donald Horne account of A Lucky Country, is highly ironic. It's translated 3 years later by Gaetano Rando, who was an Italian academic at the University of Wollongong. And Australian reviewers didn't really know what to make of it when it first came out.
Can I just ask, is this a memoir or is this a novel? How's she written this story that sounds like it's quite an angry story?
Yeah, well, it's most extraordinary, I think, in its voice and textuality. So some of it's based on Capiello's own understanding, but the narrative style is so extraordinary. It's really explosive, digressive, hyperbolic, really frank about many things, but it's also amused and tender. It's got lots of caricatured characters who are kind of satirised and excessive, and they've got monstrous self-obsessions and self-pity that... So there's a lot of satire there of all these characters, and Rosa's cast as sort of the observant, disengaged writer who is at sea in this world and begins to lose her bearings and begins to lose her voice and her... It's one of those novels about young women who experience the world around them as almost impossible. It's a very modernist novel, very experimental, and really busts the boundaries of what we might think a kind of migrant novel should be like. It's definitely not a grateful novel, and it's not a novel that is reflective of a kind of life memoir model. It's the opposite.
So it's not grateful. It's not saying this is the promised land, and it's playing around with form. Is that why it hasn't perhaps remained to the forefront in a way by your description of it? It should have.
Yeah, I think so. It sits, I think, in the middle of the 1980s when we did see this growth of a lot of writers from non-English speaking backgrounds, especially from second generation migrants, or some of them first wave migrants coming from Europe in particular. So we can think of the poet Anya Vulvich and Anna Kawani, Apayo, from Melbourne, of course, who still has quite a high profile there too, who were really interested in experimenting with pushing the boundaries in a postmodern way of how to write about Australia. And I think that we've lost that sense of a migrant writing that might push the boundaries of what Australian writing can be formally rather than just through content. And that's partly, I think, because in the last 30 years around the world, a realist aesthetic has really triumphed. It's hard to read experimentalist writing from the past, for especially the recent past. It can often feel just a bit too, at once too close to us and too strange.
And that's Rosa Capiello's O Lucky Country, published in English, translated into English and published in Australia in 1984. Nicole Moore, what is your third choice?
So my third choice is a little bit closer to my heart and not quite so much of perhaps an excoriating critique of the nation, which perhaps our readers will be pleased. This one is also from the 1980s and from one of Australia's best-known writers of that period, Dorothy Hewett, who was a legend in her own lifetime, as we may say, so had an enormous reputation, was a figure of great charisma and great interest and hugely idiosyncratic. Many of your readers and listeners will have heard of her.
Can you remind us who she was, though, for people who haven't encountered the work of Dorothy Hewett?
I think she's best known now as a playwright, more than 30 plays, and her plays were certainly breakthrough works from the 1960s and onwards. Her Chapel Perilous is perhaps her best remembered from 1971, which was received at the time as Australia's first effectively second wave feminist play, but an extraordinary success around the country. And others may remember The Man from Muckanuppin, which was produced first to celebrate Western Australia's sesquicentenary in 1979. But for many of us, it was set on high school syllabi for decades after that. It's a beautiful and hilarious Australian musical about the history of settlement in Australia. And another one of those texts we have from Australian writers, which asks us about what it is to be Australian and holds our consciences up to be examined, particularly about frontier violence, that one. Her plays are best remembered, but she was a poet first of all. She loved being a poet. That was her closest held practice. And she was an awarded poet from the time she was 21, during the Second World War. She wrote right across much of the second half of the 20th century and had an extraordinary life. So three husbands, six children, was a communist from 1945 to 1968, and then had another life as a key writer of the second wave feminism in Australia, and then wrote in the 1980s and into the 1990s about ageing and sexuality. She had an extraordinary physical presence. She grew her hair really long and grey. She dealt with crippling arthritis in her later age, but also had an incredibly frank and provocative feminist voice that she refused to be silenced. She has a six-volume ASIOphile. Australia was very concerned about her influence on all of us. So she really doesn't deserve to be forgotten.
And her memoir, Wildcard, is a wild read. But what is the book of hers that you would want to nominate, Nicole Moore, as part of your top three?
Yeah, so I'm nominating Alice in Wormland, which from 1985, I think, which is what I think of as her best resolved and most adventurous poetry collection. And it's called Alice in Wormland because she riffs off Alice in Wonderland to play with it, but it's also a deeply autobiographical poetry collection, and the collection as a whole works as a sequence. So it's a tightly controlled full sequence that does the full arc of Hewett's life, imagined via this persona of the Alice persona, which she said freed her from a kind of self-obsessed pronoun, the terrible I, as she called it. So she was moving on from the confessional poetry that she'd been writing in the 1960s in particular. And it's full of her love of witty ventriloquism and poetic impersonations. And it's a new form, I think, of autobiographical poetry with all this inherited myth and a kind of lambasted version of her own life. So I think it's just extraordinary in terms of Australian poetic history because it has this absolutely inimical tone, I think. Nobody else gets it the way she does. So it's sort of full of this fabulous mythic imagery, yet it's also acerbic and sarcastic.
So does that mean it's funny?
Yes, absolutely. Hewitt's very direct and frank voice, so she switches registers, I guess is how we talk about it, from the magical to the absurd to the, you know, pathetic really quickly. So lots of vulgarity, of course, is to be expect from Hewitt, and lots of satire, especially of the voice itself, of her own autobiographical voice.
Professor Nicole Moore from the University of New South Wales, who specialises in Australian literature and in the history of censorship. She's a stalwart of the Association for the Study of Australian Literature, and her top three Australian books were, in chronological order, William Lane's The Working Man's Paradise from 1892, Rosa Capiello's O Lucky Country from 1984, translated from Italian, and the poetry collection Alice in Wormland from 1987 by Dorothy Hewitt. And I should add that Nicole Moore is also working on a biography of that writer, Dorothy Hewitt, which will hopefully be published next year. That's it for this edition of The Bookshelf. I'm Kate Evans. Cassie McCullough will be back with me next time with a whole stack of books ready to read. Join us again then, won't you?
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.